So you said you're a writer who comes from books rather than from experience, or your writing doesn't arise out of any particular trauma, but your writing life is intimately tied to a reading life begun in childhood with, and I think what makes your novels and your critical essays so exciting to follow as they come out is that you seem to be an essayist from the get-go, in a way, that your curiosity is so bound to ideas, and I think a commitment to thinking about maybe the big questions that motivate the humanities in general, the question of the human condition. So it's to say, you know, who am I, who do I become, who should I become, subject and object and the nature of reality, as Will could say. And I'm wondering, since these seem to be the questions of your own peculiar foundational canon, and these are works you read from, I think, you say, the ages of 9 to about 15, that you deal with already in your essays and the ones collected, I'm thinking in particular, in Changing My Mind. And I'm wondering, how have you moved since Changing My Mind, your last book of essays, to the essays you're currently writing? And I know one of them is an eventually forthcoming book called, right now anyway, Feel Free.
Yeah.
So how do you move from Changing Your Mind to Feeling Free? And what kind of movement does that entail? And is there some kind of dialectical, developmental, existential movement from, you know,
from
changing your mind
other.
To feeling free? And also, I guess, are you dealing with the same kind of foundational archive of texts for you, and thinking about them differently, or what kind
no,
of
I,
topics are you
thinking I'm
about?
Not, I think that's the main difference, is that I'm not interested anymore in the books that I grew up with. It became clear to me, maybe it's just as you get older and you have children, just how the situation, it's something to do with the situation in England for black people, and I think it's reflected in the way I read, is that I was trying to get their approval, I think. I was trying to demonstrate that I could read their stuff well. And part of that was just structural, because there was no way of me to get to university if I didn't do that. You understand, it is a it's a free system in that it doesn't cost any money, or it didn't cost any money. And I understood that I could get to Cambridge for no money, but it's conditional on you learning a certain amount of things in a certain way. So I was very determined upon doing that. And I guess my mother too, like I had various moments along the way where I thought, I didn't know if I could do it, and her opinion was, it's a means to an end. You just have to go through this and you'll come out the other end. And I think she was right. Now, I think it was foundational, and it's given me a lot of freedom at the other end. But now that I am 40, I'm not really interested in being the good student anymore, you know? I think it dominated so much of my life, because it was a meritocratic system, supposedly, and you had to be a very good girl to get through it. Yeah, but now that I'm in America, as it's a traditional influence of America, I stopped behaving myself.
Okay, so now that you have a certain kind of mastery, and thereby the ability to turn away from the problem, what are you? You've said before that you take bits and ideas from books that you love, like a magpie, and I'm wondering, how has that process changed since you've kind of overcome through mastery of these foundational books? What are you taking from now, mostly? What are you reading?
It just depends. Like, I have no... it can be a brand new writer. Like, there's a girl straight out the gate, a woman called... I think her name is Otessa Moshveg. I don't know how old she is, but I read a story of hers, and when somebody's very good, you see immediately what you can learn. And I was very struck by her voice, which is... there's another ex-student of mine called Greg Jackson, who's just coming out with the book too, is similar. This kind of loose, wild voice that I haven't heard since the 70s in America. You know, a kind of... It's hard to explain, but just some kind of freedom, I guess, that I recognized and was interested in. So it can be that, or it can be suddenly reading a lot of Schopenhauer, or at the moment I guess I'm very involved in West African stuff, theory, art, folk tales, song. So it just, it depends. I don't, it's not prescriptive, it's just what falls in front of me and interests me.
Yeah.
But I do try and keep an openness that there might be some 22-year-old who writes well enough that they have something to teach you.
Yeah, and if Schopenhauer, you've got a piece out in the, can you hear me now? The New York Review of Books this week on Schopenhauer and Charlie Kaufman's and Emily Sif, which I don't know if the theme of suffering,
I think definitely I was writing a story around the same time. I think part of the thing with having children is that I just, I'm not going to have that thing that, maybe when I was young and I used to look at Zora Neale Hurston, for example. She was an adventuress, you know, she's like in a car, she's got a gun on her hip, she's traveling through the South, she's doing whatever she wants, and using it for material, going to Haiti, and like, that's not my life. I must have chosen not to live that way. I did, I chose a basically bourgeois life. My life is small. So the things that are in front of me, I have to use what's right in front of me. The movie I saw on Friday, the book that's on my shelf, the thing that my child said. I have to use what's in front of me. And I guess I have to have faith that even the smallest things have something. You don't have to go shoot an elephant. There are things right in front of you that might be worth writing about. I have to believe that. Until they're older and I can start going around the South with a gun on my head, whatever it is I'm going to start doing at that point.
Your status as, or commitment to a locality, where you're from and where you grew up, at the same time your career is born into a really quick fame, which has made you into a global writer. And I'm thinking, I was reading somewhere about how, I guess, White Teeth at least has been translated into at least 20 languages, and that was probably from the book jacket 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, maybe this is a different consideration of how you craft something now. We had a woman here a couple of years ago, a critic from Rutgers, who has written a book called Born Translated, and she's talking about Rebecca Walkowitz, how people now, writers now, often in this global world of exchange, have started to craft their book to be understandable in translation. And how does that affect, I suppose, not just your life in New York, your life in London, your travels to West Africa right now, how does being a kind of global denizen and affect the way you write?
Sometimes it does. I notice sometimes that because I've been through it so many times with the Norwegians or the Italians, or these bits of dialogue that they just, like, what have you done now? How can I translate this? But I think I notice it with my brothers, who are like, one's a comedian, one's a rapper, and they're both intensely local and obsessive with local material. And I think maybe in our house it was a lesson from hip-hop that the local can be global. In fact, the more intensely local it is, the more people respond to it. Like, when we were kids listening to songs about Compton or songs about Brooklyn or about Macy Projects, or, like, to me, those are places of my life. I've never stepped into them, but they're places of my life. So I think I had a kind of confidence that something intensely local does not stop it spreading, does not stop people thinking. Like, Willesden is basically just a border place, right? It's not the center of a city, it's somewhere out on the outskirts, it's not exactly a ghetto, it's not exactly a middle class place, it's like a weird lower middle class liminal space. And it turns out that's everywhere. Everybody knows that place, everyone's lived there, and knows the unusual mix of people you find there, and the description of life as, you know, either ghetto, middle class, or aristocratic is not a fair representation of the way many people live in a much more complex community. So to me, that's what Willesden is. It's the place which is not the center. You definitely don't get a cab from the airport to Willesden. But at some point in your life, you'll probably live there when things aren't going that well. I like that about it, and I think it's everywhere, Willesden, in that space.
The next thing I wanted to ask you about, and this has to do, I think, you know, in some sense with difficulty also, but mostly with the idea of a different way of engaging the reader, and that is about some kind of ethical project. But I'm wondering, and you haven't been funny, about how humor works in your writing. So humor and comedy so often work in some sense as some kind of an ethical vehicle, giving us new perspective on the things we all recognize already. And you said when White the Tooth came out that you were surprised that it was taken as a comic novel at first.
Yeah, I think I really didn't understand what was going on in my family. Was not a normal way of being in the world. You know, I didn't think that it was a particularly funny environment. But it has really struck me, like with my brother, he was a teacher until fairly recently, and then one day he just said, I'm going to be a comedian. And then within a year, he was like on British TV every bloody day, as far as I can tell. So it was clearly like in us generally, this kind of comic atmosphere. And we certainly, me and my brother, before my little brother turned up, did a lot of comedy routines. We used to listen to comedy records. We used to reenact famous comedy duos, you know, for our parents from the TV. We did all that stuff. We were very preoccupied with that stuff. So I see how it went into the writing. And there's a comic tradition in England which I love, and also a comic tradition in America that I particularly love. But certainly recently I have noticed that I am writing less funny. You know, as you get older, life gets a lot less funny. Probably notice this. And so I can't, it's harder for me. And I also think Ben, when I go and see his stand-up now, he's become so, that's so what he does now, that I guess I kind of slightly backed away from it, because he's really doing the pure, he's a joke meister, that's his thing now.
One of the things I think, one of my favorite essays in Changing My Mind is the essay Dead Men Laughing.
As when he becomes a comedian,
Yeah, exactly, and it has a lot to do with not just humor, but humor, you know, unto death, or in the proximity of life and death, and no good will come of this. This idea that there's not, there's an infinite amount of hope, not for us. So there's a certain kind of, I'm curious about whether, in that particular essay, for example, you talk about, you know, your nervousness about whether your brother's going to kill or die on stage.
Yeah.
So do you deploy humor, I guess, differently? I mean, if it were kind of by chance that it was funny, or this is just part of
humor? No, it's a tool sometimes, particularly writing about things which are difficult. I mean, when I watch my brother do it, you know, it's his way of talking about race and class in England, which is a very awkward conversation to have in Britain most of the time, and he gets away with it. You know, he can say really whatever he wants in that space of comedy. But I think we both feel that the instinct to be funny is not—it's—it's not the sign of a happy person. I think Ben thinks that. That's what I think. And we both read—I read that Alison Bechdel book, Are You My Mother? And I sent it to my brother afterwards. And I think we both recognised her. She's talking about Winnicott, this British psychologist who pointed out that children who seem to be very good at impersonations and very good at what looks like empathy, I guess, as an adult, it is also kind of a symptom. I mean, not to put my family in it too much, but if you're a child in a situation where the parental figure is in some way unpredictable, small children have to respond in very creative ways to the unpredictability. They have to be, oh, is she upset? Is she angry? Is she this? Is she that? And I think that impersonation that you have to put on for this parent looks a lot like what actors do, what comedians do, what writers do, and perhaps also explains why, despite all these people supposedly being so wonderful at empathy, their lives are such total car crashes, because if it was actually therapeutic, wouldn't they all be doing better? Wouldn't comedians be skipping down the street laughing? No, that's not what happens. So to me, it is a symptom which can be effectively managed in these forms, with the most extreme end being stand-ups, for sure.
Yeah.
By which I'm saying, I'm better than my brother. I'm healthier. Mentally.
You're doing that full of hate. Yeah. Yes. Okay. My other question is the other extreme. Not so much humor, but you once said in an interview, I have to put all my energy into not being religious. It's a daily effort. I don't know if you remember saying
that. Yeah, vaguely.
you go on to suggest that the kind of, you know, maybe secular yearning for something spiritual that you're getting at with that kind of comment is something we all kind of feel but don't admit to or don't really want to admit to. I'm working on Wittgenstein right now, and he once said famously, I think, I'm not a religious man, but I can't help seeing every problem from a religious point of view.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, do you have such a secular religious point of view that also informs your ability to articulate what's extraordinary in the everyday that you look at in giving us a new understanding of everydayness and what is sacred about it, I suppose?
I think it came out of, I remember reading Emerson for the first time and realizing that I think my brothers have it too, a kind of over-programmed like aesthetic bliss. Like, I get a lot out of the world. Like, even when I'm feeling depressed, if I wake up in the morning and, like, I get a lot out of a little, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, the odd flower, the sunbeam, like, I really get overexcited about these things. And I think certainly Ben, my middle brother, has it too. And I have a very clear memory of I'm sorry for the people of faith in the audience, but of arguing him out of Jesus, poor boy, at age about 10. He was like, but I think it probably he's real. And I was like, no. I gave him a long lecture. He is now a Christian. Don't worry. He went there anyway. But I think that was quite a strong instinct of us as children. We were in a very atheistic household because my mother had come from the Witnesses and had a very bad experience, I guess, as a child. So it was very, dogmatically atheistic household. And so maybe that's what happens, you know, your children become very interested in God one way or another. And I don't consider myself fortunate to be a person without faith. I find it a bit sad, actually. But I do have a great interest in faith. And for me, it's not, my instinct as a child is that they were systems of thought, systems of philosophy, which I take as seriously as I take reading Kant or reading Schopenhauer. To me, they're descriptions of the world, putting their emphasis in different places, Judaism, Islam, Christianity. And I find something compelling in all of them, and I guess I've written novels expressive of all of them, you know, one way or another, and Catholicism especially as well. They've been meaningful to me, but probably their adherents would not thank me for the way I respond to them. But to me, they are texts, you know, of some beauty. The King James Bible is one of the most beautiful things I ever read. So that's my kind of response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm thinking especially as you're talking about, I know that time is another issue that's central to the novel you're working on right now, Swing Time. It's also been central to a lot of your writing, and again, I'm thinking of N.W., where time is an obsession of the novel. And the reason I was thinking about, or that line about, you know, having to fight against being religious every day struck me, was because of this attention to, and I guess this is in a way emerging of a high modernist interest in beauty or the moment in time and boredom, and also a kind of existentialism that's going on in that book. N.W. And I'm thinking especially of weird moments of being where one is attracted to the beautiful, a blossom that looks blossomier when you think you're going to die, or
right.
Natalie's attempt to kind of tear off this, in a moment of whimsy, this pretty flower, a bush or a branch that she then has to kind of haul around with her in this awkward, crappy way, and it ends up getting left outside the tube station.
I have a thing about magnolias. There's things I'm noticing as the books pile up that certain things reoccur. Magnolias reoccur. There's a lot of foxes. And time. Yeah, it's not something you consciously set out to do. It's something Graham Greene says that once the books are lined up, you see the account of an obsession. But it's something that comes upon you. You don't realize it until a few of them are together. I think the time thing is very simple. I had a very old father, and in our house, that was the preoccupation. I think all the children thought about death all the time, much more than children probably should. And that's it. I just it always seemed to me from the very earliest age that life was incredibly short, foreshortened, like that Kafka story where it's not long enough to get to the next village. That's just always been my experience. When I was young, I never felt young. I just felt like it's going to be gone in a minute. I was right, by the way. It's gone in a minute. And I always had a panic about it. And so poets like Philip Larkin, writers like Kafka, was very vulnerable to people who have this preoccupation with time. But I think it's got a little bit better. And also I'm more interested in, there's this lovely line in Panin I was just teaching where it's like a meta comment on the novel. Nabokov has one of his characters say about a writer that you don't know who it is. But don't you think that all his novels are about the fantastic recurrence of certain things? And to me that's what Nabokov is about. And really, I bow at his knees, but that's my preoccupation. And it's a kind of religious feeling that there are things that almost fantastically reoccur. Beautiful things over and over and over throughout history. And that's as close to the sacred as I get, I guess, the idea that the girl who kneels to tie her shoe also did it in 1890 and 1712 and in the same position, the same gesture. To me, that's meaningful. I don't really know why.
Yeah, this may be a stretch, but I'm thinking of the kind of recurrence of an action seen almost vaguely. And this is, I mean, maybe this is too specific, but one of the things that resonated with me, I'm about to teach NWSI, but I've been thinking about that a lot, in terms of Wolf or Mrs. Dalloway. So I suppose one of the things I've been thinking about are the ways that Wolf uses kind of indexical pronouns and deictic bits and that and now. And I'm not sure how that kind of vagueness works with this repeated kind of
It feels like an archetype. Think of that Larkin poem, Home Is So Sad. The last two words are that vase, you would say. I would say that vase. There's something weird about it. It's like he's saying that vase. Why is it so meaningful to us? Something about the generality of it. It's his vase, it's your vase, it's all vases in the history of vases. It's incredibly powerful, that writing, that kind of archetypal writing. And it's something I aspire to. I was trying to do it in that story to try and talk about the things that are in some sense eternal, recurring. And I guess in Swing Time, the thing that's important to me is the idea of race. Things that you stop being allowed to say, but as a child were always meaningful to me. Like, what is my tribe? Is it just the Jamaican Britons? Or is it the entire diaspora? And the fact that when I go to West Africa and I see a girl dance in the middle of nowhere, in a tiny village, and I can see the same moves that I can see in a Beyoncé video. She's never seen a television, she's never... The continuity of certain things, which to me is beautiful, and the significance you take from that continuity, why does the girl here dance like the girl here in a completely different culture, and to me that is something to do with race, something to do with tribes, that I find beautiful. And of course it's been gathered as something to condemn people for. All these people have the same trait, they think the same way, they look the same way. Race is always determined in this negative sense. But the communality of experience, the sameness that does exist across oceans, across specific cultural situations, is also beautiful. Like, race is absolutely on that line. It's the collectivity that you disparage. No, I'm not part of this thing. We're all different, we're all individuals. At the same point, these are my people. We are together, this is a community. Even if we don't know each other hand in hand. So that interests me, that very line which makes everybody so anxious. It's right there that I like to write about.
Well, it comes through in the story you're reading today.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And I also was thinking as you were reading it, something that touches upon another question, and that is, so you're the creator of things made of words, but I was thinking of how cinematic, in some sense, or edited, perhaps, that story, especially its beginning, depending, was. And I'm wondering about how, I know you have, are working on screenplays.
Yeah.
We have Cambodia, and I wondered how it is to, A, adapt your own thing, how it's different from creating something out of images that are visual images, not linguistic ones.
I'm doing it with my husband. I guess what's interesting about it, I know we've had a lot of this debate recently, but I have to be honest, working on the other side, it's just true. My problem in Hollywood or whatever is that I hadn't even noticed that my scripts do not tend to, their star is not a white woman in her mid-20s. And if you don't have that, it's really hard. Like, it's really hard. I just didn't even consider it. And like some of these scripts, they're just not focused it to that person. And so it gets difficult. And then, I mean, The Embassy of Cambodia is about a West African girl. And so it's like the casting is Lupita and that's it, that's all. So if Lupita doesn't call you back, it's like, oh, that's that then. So it's there's not a lot of, call me Lupita, please. There's not a lot of movement, there's not a lot of places to go, which is tricky. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that casting stuff, which it's really frustrating. It's better here in America than in Britain, actually, but it's still really frustrating. And so I'm trying not to let it influence what we're writing, because we have these scripts, we want to make them, and, you know, they're ready and it's exciting, but it's so hard to convince people that these stories are not, like, minority interest stories. I don't know. On TV, I think it's going a lot better, right? It just seems to be going a lot better. But in film, it's really hard still. So that's what we're doing at the moment. Actually adapting them, the practical matter of it, has been really fun. For me, it's less work. I do the dialogue, I just have fun, and Nick constructs gives it a structure. So stories of mine are often not very well structured, and he plots them into a film, and then I can do the dialogue. So it's just so much quicker than novel writing. And we can do it together. You know, it's less lonely. There's a lot of good things that I like about it. But the business side is... It's not easy.
Yeah, so is it getting anywhere as far as...
Well, if Lupita would call us back, that would help.
Can't you just write her and say hi?
I've tried. She's so busy, she's doing Star Wars. You know, busy, she is. hopefully it'll move forward. And we have a really big TV show that we're working on together, which is really exciting, with a very huge mixed cast. Set in Hollywood in the 30s, about a young black girl, a young gay guy trying to make it in Hollywood in like 1936. So it's like fun, you know. It's like all the stuff I loved as a kid, but get to play with this bigger tool set, and that whole black white Hollywood thing then was really fascinating. So it's fun for me. It's like playtime. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe weird thing, maybe apocryphal thing I want to ask you about, because I'm fascinated by this, and that is the Kafka musical, which is maybe it's not even true.
It's not untrue. In fact, I found some files on it. We had quite a large book on it, and we had some songs, but I think I had my daughter, and it just fell by the wayside, but I'd love to come back to it. It was like a Kurt Weill idea, like an operetta, basically. Yeah. I was excited by it.
I was just trying to figure out what it was. Song and dance number, like a vaudeville.
No, it was quite like kind of Berlin-y, you know, it was that kind of vibe. But it's just that I wanted to emphasize the drama of Kafka's life, which is really quite dramatic, like lots of broken engagements, just lots of activity, much more than people realize. And he's a great character, I think. Yeah, hopefully one.